Welcome to the Open Scroll audio series. The study you're about to hear was written by Bob Schlenker and is being read by Aaron Herman. Since the time of its recording, this study's been retitled from Beyond the Veil to When Cometh That Thief in the Night.
Jacob's dying words prophesy the celestial sign of the Lord's return in judgment. When the patriarch Jacob lay dying, he prophesied about each of his sons. When he spoke about Judah as a lion, he was testifying about the lion of the tribe of Judah, the Messiah, and his coming in judgment. This very cryptic prophecy contains some language that I had learned many years ago to see in a celestial context, because the author and respected scholar, E.W. Bullinger, had written about the lion as a reference to the constellation Leo. From ancient times, Leo has been drawn on star maps as a lion. There was much more to be learned about Jacob's prophecy. Much more. This is my testimony about that prophecy, which the Bible records in the 49th chapter of Genesis, that a celestial sign was given that would establish the time of the Messiah's return in judgment. On his deathbed, Jacob dramatically described a distant time in the language of the celestial clock. The one, we are told, was appointed for such things in the record of the fourth day of creation. This sign is of such a nature that it allows us to synchronize our calendar with the Creator's. Having this critical anchoring in time, it functions as a kind of cornerstone. A cornerstone is the first stone set in the construction of a masonry foundation. All other stones are set in reference to this stone, thus locating the entire structure. Bible prophecy about the end times is that structure, and the time when the sign Jacob prophesied was fulfilled is its cornerstone. You'll notice some sidebar material, and per our usual, I will continue on with the main text, and once that's finished, we'll come back and address what's in the sidebar. For now, let's continue on with the main text. What I'm describing isn't something new, but is strictly according to the standard way of accounting the passage of time on the Lord's calendar. Each month the days are counted off. Month after month, time is counted off from the first day to the last. The time when a month begins is determined by witnessing a celestial sign. More precisely, two in combination. Witnesses see the first crescent of a new moon, then the next month begins at sunset. Celestial signs mark the time when the days begin to be counted off. By identifying a day as, for example, the 10th day of a month, we reference the time when the count began. The month is built off that moment as an edifice is off its cornerstone. Holy days in the Lord's calendar are related to those lunar counts, with a small number of other factors entering into the calculations for some of them, but relative counts are always involved that hinge on well-defined points of reference. The annual calendar is reset with the first month depending upon the report of witnesses who watch the barley crop for a sign, a kind of sign that involves the motions of the earth through the heavens. A sign for the Neo-Magi. In May of 1991, I was living in Northern California and working as a floor covering contractor. I had already been a very zealous Christian for over 11 years, but had recently gone through a crisis that forced me to reassess what I thought I knew about faith. I didn't know what had happened to me at the time, but an apostolic anointing for the last days had been released, and I was anointed. The Lord enabled me and led me back through the Bible to study out the matter with a willingness to reject everything I thought I knew and to accept whatever I found. Thank you, Lord. One night, while I was working at a client's house, their TV was on, and during the dinner hour news, I overheard that there was an interesting celestial display in progress. The weatherman said there would be three bright planets doing an inversion of order just after dark in the western sky. I had just bought my first computer and had installed an astronomy program. With it, I was able to view the heavens as they were at any given time in history, and as they are expected to be in the future, if they continue consistently. When I got home from work, I used the animation function to set the planets in motion and observe their positions relative to each other and against the backdrop of the stars. By means of this simulation, I previewed on my computer the events I would see in the heavens over the coming months. It was just as the weatherman had said. Three planets were lined up. The slowest one was in the lead, and the fastest moving one was behind the slower two. Eventually, in mid-June, the three planets came really close together, bunching up in the constellation Cancer. Then the fastest one passed the other two and moved out front, while the slowest one dropped into last position. They were inverted. This was fascinating to me, and I watched the animation several times. As I let the animation run on through the summer months to see if anything else interesting was going to happen, I came to a startling realization. On my monitor there appeared a familiar configuration, a massing of the planets Mars, Mercury, Venus, and Jupiter in the zodiacal constellation Leo. This particular configuration was familiar because I had seen a very similar picture in one of my books in my library. A book based upon the work of Dr. Ernest Martin had done in the late 1970s and early 80s. This book made known the author's view of the celestial sign that attended the Messiah's birth, as described in Revelation 12:1, suggesting that this had been a sign witnessed by the Magi. The massing of the same four planets in Leo that the Magi had surely seen almost 2,000 years earlier was about to appear in the late summer sky. I felt strongly in my spirit that this was extremely significant. In amazement, I recall praying and pondering what the reappearance of this sign could mean. As I continued to animate the planets on my computer, a very interesting configuration appeared. If I was intrigued and excited before, I became much more so upon this discovery. My spirit soared. As I began to search out the meaning of what I was finding, I checked Bullinger's commentary about Leo in one of my favorite resources, The Witness of the Stars. He pointed out that the significance of Leo could be seen as the line of Genesis 49, verses 8 and 9. When I turned in my Bible to that passage, Jacob's deathbed prophecy about his son Judah, I just about shot through the ceiling. That was it. What I found so stunning on my monitor was described by Jacob in language that was cryptic, but that I could interpret clearly enough. I rejoiced and praised his holy name. The Lord was coming. The verse that describes the celestial sign of the Lord's return and judgment is similar to the one that describes the sign that attended the Lord's birth, but it's really far less apparent that it's celestial in nature. Before I explain the esoteric celestial symbolism, I'm going to give the rest of the prophecy a rather lengthy consideration for the sake of establishing the context that gives meaning to the associated celestial sign. The context, Jacob's deathbed prophecy. In the 49th chapter of the book of Genesis, Jacob offered his final prophecy about each of his sons. And Jacob called unto his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days." Genesis 49, verse 1. Verses 8 through 12 relate to us Jacob's prophecy about Judah. "Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk." Genesis 49, verses 8 through 12. According to the style of inquiry into the deeper things of the Holy Scriptures noted in the book of the prophet Isaiah, we are going to divulge the mysteries of Jacob's deathbed revelation about his progeny. "Whom shall he teach knowledge? And whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk, and drawn from the breasts. For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. Isaiah 28, verses 9 and 10. Jacob's prophecy parallels some others that are worth noting. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God, the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Revelation 19, verses 11 through 16. Genesis 49, verses 8 through 12. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Genesis 49, verse 8a. The name Judah means praise. Whenever you see the meaning of the name of a person in a verse where their name appears, pay attention. There is an important lesson to be found. One descended from Judah, Jesus Christ, will certainly receive much praise at the time suggested by this prophecy. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Genesis 49, verse 8b. A similar phrase is found in 2 Samuel chapter 22. And mine enemies thou givest to me the neck, those hating me, and I cut them off. 2 Samuel 22, verse 41. This entire chapter in 2 Samuel is a song that David sang to the Lord, a song repeated in its entirety as Psalm 18. This song not only describes David's deliverance by the hand of the Lord, but also is prophetic of one who would come from his lineage, the son of David, Jesus Christ. This allusion suggests an event that is frequently addressed in prophetic scriptures and known as the Campaign of Armageddon. This campaign will occur just prior to the reign of Yeshua HaMashiach from Zion. It represents the Messiah's authority over his enemies being known. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Genesis 49, verse 8c. Philippians 2:10 declares that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth. This will happen when his enemies have been put under his feet and he is exalted. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? Genesis 49, verse 19. Yeshua is the lion of the tribe of Judah. Notice how the context is the opening of the seal judgments. And one of the elders said to me, "Stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals." Revelation 5, verse 5. This begins allusion to Balaam's oracles recorded in Numbers. Here's the second oracle. Then he took up his discourse and said, "Arise, O Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. When he has blessed, then I cannot revoke it. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of the wild ox. For there is no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. At the proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Behold, a people arises like a lioness, and as a lion it lifts itself. It will not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain." Numbers 23, verses 18 through 24. In Jacob's prophecy, it says, "From the prey, my son, you have gone up." Whose son is the lion who will fulfill these prophecies? Is it literally Judah, Jacob's son, or is it Jesus Christ, God's son, the lion of the tribe of Judah? Of course, it's Jesus, again, at his return in judgment. Balaam prophesied about what would happen shortly, which prophecy can be seen to have been a foreshadowing of that which would happen later when the lion of the tribe of Judah would come in judgment. Balaam said, "He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them." The shout of the king is among them, not just any old king, and no misfortune or misery is observed in them when this prophecy is fulfilled. This is yet future, but no longer distant. Consider the last part of the prophecy again. "At the proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Behold, a people rises like a lioness, and as a lion it lifts itself. It will not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. The people of Israel did and will do like the lion." Balaam's third oracle reads as follows. He took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered." Numbers 24, verses 3 and 4. This is the same kind of response other prophets like Daniel and Jeremiah had when the Lord revealed details about the fulfillment of the vision in the end times. This, too, is the context of Balaam's oracle. It continues, "How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens beside the river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water will flow from his buckets, and his seed will be by many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted." Numbers 24, verses 5 through 7. This is a common prophetic description of the way it will be for Israel during the time that will follow right after the execution of judgment upon the wicked. Continuing again, "God brings him out of Egypt. He is for him like the horns of the wild ox. He will devour the nations who are his adversaries, and will crush their bones in pieces, and shatter them with his arrows. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him? Blessed is everyone who blesses you, and cursed is everyone who curses you." Numbers 24, verses 8 and 9. See, verse 9a is identical to the phrase in Jacob's prophecy in the Hebrew, except that the word translated "lie down" differ very slightly. The basis for judgment being executed in the day denoted in this prophecy will be exactly as Balaam prophesied. Those of the nations, the Gentile nations, will be judged according to their treatment of Israel. Those who bless Israel will be blessed. Those who curse Israel will be cursed. "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet." Genesis 49, verse 10a. Now, here's the first in a series of celestial references to be discovered through tracking the source of the allusions made in Jacob's prophecy about Judah. Balaam's fourth oracle is as follows. He took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down, yet having his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel, and shall crush through the forehead of Moab, and tear down all the sons of Sheth." Numbers 24, verses 15 through 17. The Hebrew word for scepter in Genesis 49, verse 10, is the same word used here in verse 17 for scepter. The star, which came out of Jacob, would appear to be the very star of Bethlehem, who appeared to guide the ancient Magi. This star is associated with this scepter, symbolic of Jesus Christ. It is he, the coming king and Messiah, who was beheld by Balaam. It is he who will crush the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of all the sons of Sheth. Moab and the sons of Sheth are symbolic of those who still reject the judge of all men when he appears. This judgment, described as crushing the foreheads and the skulls, is according to the prophecy given to the serpent by God himself. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. Genesis 3, verse 15. Until Shiloh comes, or until he comes to whom it belongs. Genesis 49, verse 10b. In reading this verse, we have to ask, to whom what belongs? Because the answer isn't supplied directly, the figure of speech, ellipsis, is being employed. This literary device draws our attention to the missing word. Upon consideration of the context, I think it becomes rather obvious that the word judgment is most appropriate. A ruler's scepter of judgment, or rod. The aspect of judgment that appears so prominently in the passages to which allusion is by this device brought emphatically to our attention. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Genesis 49, verse 10c. The obedience of the peoples will be Christ's at his return as king. Remember that every knee shall bow. Also, recall Revelation 19, verse 15a, read earlier. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. The words of the prophet Isaiah seem equally relevant. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Isaiah 11, verses 3 and 4. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. Genesis 49, verse 11a. Remember Jesus riding a donkey in the gospel record? Jesus, finding a young donkey, sat on it, as it is written, "Fear not, daughter of Zion. Behold, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt." John 12, verses 14 and 15. Jesus quoted Zechariah 9, verse 9. Thus, we know that what Jesus did in John 12 fulfilled the prophecy given in Zechariah. The Gospels record not one, but two entries into Jerusalem. He rode both on a donkey and a colt. Bullinger wrote, "But when he came on the one, an ass's colt, it was in judgment, to pronounce the doom on the city and on the nation." This judgment was pronounced when the king rode in on the colt. It appears that the judgment will be executed when the king tethers his colt. This vine seems to represent all the people of Israel. The choicest branch may be representative specifically of Judah, as when Israel was divided into two kingdoms. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. Genesis 49, verse 11b. When wine is made in the Eastern culture, the grapes in the wine press are literally tread upon with their feet, and the red juice splatters their garments. Wine and grapes are associated with the wrath of God, as can be seen in Revelation 14, verse 10, and in chapter 19, which has already been noted. Consider the following passage. Who is this who comes from Edom, with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red, and your garments like the one who treads in the winepress? I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger, and trampled them in my wrath. And their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. I looked, and there was no one to help, and I was astonished, and there was no one to uphold. So my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. I trod down the peoples in my anger, and I made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. The meaning of all these allusions in this passage in Genesis 49 is clear. The theme is that of judgment being executed upon the ungodly at the coming of Christ. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk. Genesis 49, verse 12. This reference to Jesus' appearance indicates that it will be rather striking at the time implied. The picture of health. He will be a sight to behold. The celestial theme. Now that Yeshua's return in judgment as the Lion of the tribe of Judah has been thoroughly established as a theme of the prophecy, let's turn our attention to the celestial theme. The zodiacal constellation Leo, with its first decan Hydra, are suggested in the phrase from verse 8, "Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies." The sky charts depict Leo as a lion, with his front paws just about on the neck of Hydra, his enemy, the serpent. The stars tell their messages through the words that have been associated with them. Because they are named, and their names have meanings, and because they are organized into groups, which also have names, and pictures drawn around them, the words tell a story. Here are some of the meanings of the ancient names of Hydra and Leo, and of some of the stars in them. Not too surprisingly, the story told here is in harmony with the story told in Jacob's prophecy. In Hydra, which means he is abhorred, we find El-Fard, which means the separated, put away, El-Drian, the abhorred, and Minkar El-Sujia, the piercing of the deceiver. Is this serpent any other than Satan himself? Bullinger wrote the following about Leo. The Hebrew name of the sign is Arya, which means the lion. There are six Hebrew words for lion, and this one is used for the lion hunting down his prey. This very word is found in Genesis 49, verse 9. He also writes, the Syriac name is Ario, the rending lion, and the Arabic is El Asad. Both mean a lion coming vehemently, leaping forth as a flame. Some of the star names in Leo are Regulus, treading underfoot, Denebola, the judge or lord who cometh, El Giba, the exaltation, Zazma, shining forth, Minshir El Asad, the punishing or tearing of the lion, Deneb Elised, the judge cometh who seizes, and El Defera, the enemy put down. This celestial testimony about the Lion of the tribe of Judah is what verse 8 refers to as it declares his destiny. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. This is the prophecy God spoke to the enemy, the serpent, in the Garden of Eden, declaring the fundamental conflict of the age between the seed of the woman and the serpent. Also from verse 8, allusion is made to a passage found earlier in Genesis. The phrase, Judah, your brothers will praise you, should rest our attention when we realize that the name Judah means praise, according to a principle I mention frequently. It is not only emphatic, but worshipful. Praise, your brothers will praise you. We are directed to the record in which the worship is given to another brother who is also symbolic of HaMashiach. Judah's brother Joseph was telling his brothers about his dreams that concerned receiving worship from his family. By these dreams, God was giving a prophecy about the exalted position of the coming Messiah. Here is Joseph's dream. Now, he had still another dream, and related it to his brothers, and said, Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. Genesis 37, verse 9. The sun and moon and stars are celestial bodies. They represented Joseph's family, with the unmentioned 12th star assumed to be Joseph himself. These stars are the same brothers who will also praise Judah, or the one Judah represents, who is the very same one Joseph represented. In the key verse, Genesis 49 verse 10, scepter is the same word used in one of Balaam's prophecies. The scepter, Shebet, shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. Into him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Genesis 49, verse 10. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter, Shebet, shall rise from Israel. Numbers 24, verse 17a. The scepter is a star. The celestial account and the interpretation of the sign. In biblical usage, a star can refer to one of a few different kinds of celestial bodies, like the distant suns we refer to today as stars or to planets, or even to heavenly beings like angels. What is this scepter that will not depart from Judah? Because we have seen the celestial theme woven into Jacob's prophecy, let's consider an interpretation within that context. Remember, in Revelation 12, verse 1, the woman described was, in the celestial context, the constellation Virgo. In Genesis 49, Judah, the lion, is the constellation Leo. Leo and Virgo are two of the 12 that lie along the path of the sun. This path is called the ecliptic. So, the sun, moon, and planets travel through Leo, just like they do through Virgo. According to the picture of the lion sign, as it has come down through history, the wandering stars, we call planets, pass through a region that is easily identified as between the feet of the lion. The word feet in verse 10 is from the Hebrew word regel, the very root word of regulus, that bright star in Leo whose name means treading underfoot. The planets don't pass over the lion's back or through his head, but between his feet. They first pass by regulus, which marks the forefeet, and continue their motion until they are beyond the region of the hind feet. Once a planet has passed regulus, before it passes beyond the hind feet, it is between the feet of the lion of Leo. The scepter and the ruler's staff are planets, not stars that are suns, and not angels. Here is an interpreted rendition. The scepter planet will not depart from Judah, the lion constellation Leo, nor the ruler's staff planet from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. This is a celestial sign. The motion of planets against the backdrop of the stars is the appointed sign marking Yeshua's coming in judgment that has been hidden in the scriptures from ages past. It's not difficult to identify which planets are the scepter and ruler's staff. Of the four planets that had just previously massed in Leo, Mars had already moved beyond Leo. Venus was in retrograde motion between Leo and Hydra, but the remaining two, Jupiter and Mercury, did something very interesting. Now, Jupiter is very slow moving relative to the other three planets, and at this stage of its cyclic retrograde motion through the heavens was making steady progress eastward toward Regulus. The star Regulus in Leo can be considered stationary because it remains fixed relative to other stars. Mercury had begun retrograde motion in the same path and at the same time as Venus, but moved more quickly to meet Jupiter at Regulus, and I do mean at Regulus. The dramatic meeting on the 10th of September in 1991 is the configuration that grabbed my attention as I observed the computer animation, because Jupiter, Mercury, and Regulus came within 1/2 of a degree of each other as viewed from Earth. To give you an idea of the proximity of this star and two planets, when I watched them early in the morning sky on that cool autumn day, I held up my little finger at arm's length, easily covered all three of these bright celestial bodies with the fingernail on my little finger. As I continued to observe the motion of these planets over the next several days, Jupiter continued its relatively slow-paced movement, but fast-moving Mercury quickly passed from between Leo's feet. The images give some indication of what this looked like. As you can see, immediately following the signal massing of four planets, a configuration was formed where two of the planets were between Leo's feet for a brief period of time. They had entered between the feet together in a very rare and eye-catching event, meeting at the four-feet star Regulus. These two planets are the scepter and the ruler's staff. They are Jupiter and Mercury. Jupiter as the scepter. The scepter represents Jupiter, the king or ruling planet that was pictured in Revelation 12:1 as a crown of 12 stars. Simple. Obvious. The following biblical reference to Jupiter and Mercury is of some help. And when the people saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in the speech of Lyconia, "The gods are come down to us in the likeness of men." And they called Barnabas Jupiter and Paul Mercurius, because he was the chief speaker. Acts 14, verses 11 and 12. Mercury is the ruler's staff. Mercurius, or Mercury, is the chief speaker. Mercury is historically known as the messenger god, the messenger planet. It's through the message-bearing aspect of Mercury that we find a link to the angel Gabriel, and in Gabriel we find another connection. The Hebrew word hachek is often translated ruler's staff, but in some versions, like the King James Version, lawgiver. Gabriel is implicated as the lawgiver, as we see the Bible's declaration that the law was given through the agency of an angel. Gabriel is typically seen as the one responsible to give messages. He's only named four times in the Bible, but is probably shown many more times performing the office of chief speaker. In Exodus 3:2, it is written that an angel appeared to Moses in the flames of a burning bush. When we read about that event in Exodus 3, we see that, although it says many times that God spoke to Moses, there must have been an angel involved who functioned as an agent for God. We read in Acts 7, verse 38, that it was an angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai when he received living words to pass on to us. This refers to the giving of the law. So we now have the agency of an angelic lawgiver. The angel who acted as God's agent in the giving of the law is not named, but Gabriel is implicated because it is he who appears to be the primary message-delivering angel. Interestingly, the NIV translators chose to describe angels as celestial beings in Jude 8. Gabriel is associated with the planet Mercury as the messenger, a celestial being, body, or star, and is quite possibly the lawgiver agent. It seems pretty plain that the lawgiver of Genesis 49:10 is the planet Mercury. The celestial interpretation of Genesis 49:10 is very simply, Jupiter will not depart from Leo, nor Mercury from between the feet until Yeshua comes in judgment. On September 10, 1991, Mercury met Jupiter at Regulus in Leo. Moving very slowly, Jupiter remained in Leo while Mercury moved rapidly eastward to exit from between the feet of the lion by the 27th of September. By then, as the prophecy declares, Yeshua had come in judgment. How could that be? Continue reading where this should become plain. Celestial date stamps. Two of a kind. The celestial prophecy of Genesis 49 is like the one in Revelation 12 verse 1, where another celestial configuration is pictured at a precise moment in time. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. Revelation 12 verse 1. That sign in Virgo is presented in the context of the birth of a son to the Virgin. A son who can be identified in the context as Yeshua. Revelation 12 verse 1 simply interprets in the celestial context like this. A great and wondrous celestial sign appeared in heaven. The sun is in the constellation of Virgo, while the moon is positioned under her feet, while Jupiter is positioned on her head. the celestial signs attended events to specifically mark them. The signs call out the event attended to those who see them coming and watch them appear. The signs also provide a means of establishing the date on any calendar, even long after the events have passed. Have you considered how the signs of Yeshua's birth set a precedent for his return? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. Genesis 49, verse 10. Genesis 49, verse 10 marks that son's coming in judgment as a lion. The celestial lights once again flooded the world with divine knowledge, as they had at his birth and baptism, pouring forth their timely testimony about the coming of the king. It is surely no coincidence that both signs, Revelation 12:1 and Genesis 49:10, followed immediately after a massing of the four planets, Jupiter, Mars, Venus, and Mercury, in the constellation Leo. This signal event is believed to have been a prompt for the Magi long ago, and it is my testimony that that observation is what initially seized my attention in 1991. God is very consistent with his prophetic messages. He gives instruction through cycles and trends. Recall the Bible's declaration that the purposes of the heavenly lights is to give light on the earth, and that the spiritual light is the message about Christ. We have seen convincing evidence that the time element is implicit to celestial signs and is a vital part of this divine testimony. Here are some interesting observations. With regard to the divine ordering of constellations in the circle of the zodiac, the Sphinx, related to the Great Pyramid in Giza, Egypt, that is referred to as the Pillar of Enoch, speaks of Virgo as the first constellation of the circle of the zodiac and of Leo as the last. There is a star in Leo named Sarkim, Hebrew, which means the joining. Because of this star's name, it seems likely that this particular star's position in the heavens marks where the two ends of the zodiacal circle meet. Thus, it may be seen that the celestial sign of Jesus' first coming appeared in the first sign in the circle of the zodiac, and the sign of his coming again appeared in the last. Full circle, as they say. Alongside this comparison, we find that an inverted ordering exists in how the celestial prophecy of Messiah's first appearance is in the last book of the Bible, Revelation, while the celestial prophecy of his latter appearance is in the first, Genesis. The manner of his coming. How is it that the judge could have come in September of 1991? We look to his first coming for the example. We're dealing with seasons that span years and involve a series of events. The seasons have beginnings and endings. God first caused a young virgin to conceive. Then his son was born. He was bar mitzvahed at age 12, baptized at about 30, and sometime after spending 40 days in the wilderness, he began to minister publicly. His earth suit flesh body ministry on earth lasted around 3.5 years until he was crucified. After 3 days in the grave, he arose in an eternal spiritual body. After another 40 days, when he appeared to bear testimony to many, he ascended into heaven. In recounting this series of events, I make the point very plainly that his coming wasn't a single event. Our Lord's presence on earth wasn't apparent to most people until he began ministering according to the messianic anointing, because that's where their focus was. Yet, by then, he had already been here for 30 years. His coming in judgment is just that same way. What was marked for our attention by the celestial prophecy in 1991 compares in some ways to his birth. The season of judgment began, and it continues until it becomes evident to the masses and ultimately reaches a dramatic conclusion. On what day do we account his coming? In this consideration, Jerusalem is the select location for reasons that should be obvious. Jupiter and Mercury were between the feet of Leo for about 2 weeks, entering in together on the 10th of September. Mercury exited by the 27th at the very latest, so Yeshua's return in judgment had begun by then. To discover which day his coming might be accounted on, we have to give consideration to the holy days on the Lord's own calendar, which has been designed to mark out important events on his schedule. It's like an appointment book. The month widely known as Tishri began at sunset on September 10th in 1991. I'm not aware of anyone who might have been watching and recording new moons back then like the Karaites do today, but we have a pretty good way to figure it out based on years of observations and the known length of time between the setting of the sun and the setting of the moon. If there is too little lag time, the moon sets before it's far enough away from the sun to be seen. On the 10th, lag time was 55 minutes, with sunset in Jerusalem at 1752 and moonset at 1847. This is comfortably in the visible range. Tishri 1 thus began at sunset on the 10th. Tishri begins like every other month, with a holy day celebrating the reappearance of the moon. It's referred to as Rosh Chodesh, meaning head of the month. However, Rosh Chodesh of Tishri is special. It's also Rosh Hashanah, meaning head of the year. This is considered to be the first day of the first month, by some accountings equivalent to New Year's Day. Biblically, it is Yom Terah, the day of shouting or trumpets. The days leading up to the next feast are known as the Days of Awe. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is celebrated on the 10th day of the month. This is the most solemn holy day of the annual cycle, and also the day marking the arrival of a Yobel, or Jubilee year. Sukkot, known as Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, or Ingathering, with reference to the harvest, is celebrated from the 15th through the 21st days of the month. There is an extension celebrated on the 22nd of the month, the 8th day of assembly, Shemoneh Atzeret. Of these, which, if any, occurred within the window of the time pictured in Genesis 49:10? Let's consider the celestial event schedule in more detail. Jupiter and Mercury entered between the feet when they passed conjunction with Regulus. Again, this is what really grabbed my attention, because Mercury met Jupiter at Regulus in very close proximity. Jupiter was in conjunction with Regulus on the 10th at about 9:30 a.m. Mercury came into conjunction with Regulus at about noon. 25 minutes later, Mercury came into conjunction with Jupiter at 10:08:01 R.A. A few hours later, the appearance of the new moon announced the arrival of Yom Terah at sunset at 1752 or 5:52 p.m. RA indicates right ascension values. Bodies in conjunction have the same RA. To give the more technically minded among you an idea of the relative motions, Regulus has a fixed position at 10:07:55 RA. So when the planets are in conjunction with Regulus, they have an identical RA value. By sunset, Jupiter had moved to 10:08:13 RA, and the quickly accelerating Mercury to 10:09:12 RA. So, within hours of this very dramatic entrance of both the scepter and lawgiver between the feet of the lion on that autumn evening of the 10th of September, Yom Terah began. While both bodies were between the feet of the lion, the Days of Awe counted off to Yom Kippur, which began at sunset on the 19th. Both planets were still between the feet for perhaps a few more days, depending upon where you account the point of exit from between the lion's feet. As far as I'm able to ascertain, establishing the point of exit is a subjective matter, requiring the interpretation of ancient renderings of the figure of the constellation's lion. None of those seem to stand out as a standard of reference, and that seems to be of little consequence. This consideration of the sign highlights two candidates, Yom Terah and Yom Kippur. Which day is it? At first, I favored Yom Kippur because it was easily in the midst of the span, but over the years, I came to lean more and more strongly toward the former, Yom Terah. The year 1991-92 was not a Yobel, so there doesn't seem to be any reason to view that particular Yom Kippur as a significant transitional day. Yom Terah, however, is always a transitional day, as it is the first of a new month and even year on two, civil and regnal, of the four kinds of calendars. Two other features speak even more loudly to me about Yom Terah. Yom Terah was the day Yeshua was born. That event was attended by the celestial sign of Revelation 12, verse 1, which very notably provided the foundation for the revelation of this sign of his coming and judgment from Genesis 49:10. That's a very substantial connection. And the celestial activity that anticipated it, which I watched with great excitement together with my family and a small number of saints, brought supreme emphasis to its arrival. When did Jesus come in judgment? My conclusion is this: Yom Terah, September 10th through the 11th, 1991. And the series of events in its season of fulfillment continues until it reaches the appointed conclusion. What I've documented here is like a foundation stone upon which the Lord built in revealing the chronology of the end times, the timeline of biblical prophetic fulfillment. What I'm going to share with you took many years to learn. Keeping the Lord's calendar requires the observation of celestial signs that begin counts, month after month. It's the sign of the new moon. Year after year, these are synchronized with a watch to determine the status of the barley crop, which is a related sign. The season of the Lord's return in judgment has its own count, which was another well-kept secret. The observation of the celestial sign established the point at which the count began. This is how the Lord made it to be. It's consistent with his way from ancient times. It was in 1999, 8 years later, that I came to learn that the sign of 1991 marked the turn of a Shemitah, one of the repeating weeks of years that began coincident with creation itself, when time in this age was initiated. It was another 7 years later, in 2008, that I learned what the judgment count was, the key to knowing how everything else I had been learning anchored to the calendar date that was established by the celestial sign of 1991. The celestial sign has been invaluable. How awesomely good our God is to us. Now let's go back and take a look at the sidebar material. The only thing that interferes with my learning is my education. Albert Einstein. As you read through and consider what you find, instead of struggling to merge this insight into everything else you think you know, try to dismiss that temptation to go for a fresh approach. That's what I've had to do. If you still find yourself struggling with questions, you may find these studies helpful. Will no one know the day? The harvest allegory. Celestial signs and the basis for biblical astronomy. When Jesus was born, the celestial signs. And when Jesus was baptized, the celestial signs. Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words, whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and, like a strong man, runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and drippings of honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned, and keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. This concludes our presentation of Jacob's dying words, prophesied the celestial sign of the Lord's return in judgment. Thank you for listening.